already know. When we look at the book of Ezra, it's very easy to break it down. The first six chapters are about, in unison. What does in unison mean? Everybody at once. In unison, the first six chapters are about rebuilding the temple. And then chapters 7 through 10, the return of Ezra. Thank you very much. We have the big dates. Maybe the most important date up there is 586, destruction of the temple, because that gives us a kind of a 70-year time frame there. 536, we have the decree of Cyrus, where they were allowed to return and build the temple. 516, we have the completion of the temple. These are big dates. Then as we come down to 458, a big time gap there. In the days of Artaxerxes, Ezra returns. Sometimes when we see the book of Ezra, we assume Ezra is there from start to finish. Such is not the case. The first six chapters are there to talk about the rebuilding of the temple, and then Ezra comes about 60 years later in chapters 7 through 10. Got to get Ezra's blank check up there. We've talked about the blank check that Artaxerxes wrote for Ezra. Glance at that briefly, because that's kind of important in relation to what we're going to be talking about tonight. He was given a huge amount of support from the Persian government. And we talked about why should they be so good to the Jews? Persian attitude toward all those they had conquered was pretty benevolent. They pretty much allowed everybody to go home. The religious outlook of Zoroastrianism, they had points in common with the Jewish religion. Wasn't the same, but you're oftentimes more kindly disposed towards somebody with whom you have points in common. And finally, it was either Xerxes or Artaxerxes, the king in Esther. Okay, the reason I kind of paused at Artaxerxes, I found out this week I'm pronouncing that name like a Texan. That's not really the way it ought to be pronounced, but that's the way you're going to get it from me. Artaxerxes, that's just the way it comes out of my mouth. Okay, now, last week we also saw that he is described as a scribe. He's never really called a prophet, as far as I can tell. He is basing his reform on the written law. He knows the law of Moses. Now, what is the problem that almost immediately jumps up upon his arrival? Concerns what? Concerns marriage. Let's read Ezra 9, verses 1 through 4. Nate Schenkel, would you read that, please? Okay, the princes make it clear that they have a part in what is going on, but they are the ones that come forward and put their finger on the problem. In verse 2, what's the problem? The people of the land have done what? They have intermarried with the people of the land. Now, last week we put it on the chart. The Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. They've intermarried with some of the people who are living in the land. They have pulled a Solomon. Now keep your finger there for just a moment and go to 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 1. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. Now this is where we are picking up this evening. We have this problem with marriages. Now if you'll notice verses 3 and 4, whatever else we say about this problem, it's one that has Ezra appalled. He's very stunned by it. And what word is used in the second verse to really describe the nature of what they had done? Okay, we have the word unfaithfulness. Clearly what they have done classifies as unfaithfulness. Now, we don't intend this to be terribly deep, but what was it about this that made it unfaithfulness? What law had they violated?
It says the holy seed. The holy seed is mixed.
Yeah. And what law does that violate? We have a couple of passages that we looked at last week. Let's turn back there. First, let's go to Exodus 34. Exodus 34, verses 11 through 16. Steve Bird, would you read that, please?
Be sure to observe what I have commanded you this day. Behold, I am going to drive out the Amorites before you, and the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Watch yourselves, that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land.
Okay, so what is the command given here? When you enter the land, what are you supposed to do with the people who are dwelling there? You kill them. Now, why do you kill them? That's good enough reason right there, but there's another reason given. God says you kill them lest what? You intermarry. And you learn their ways. So the people that are in the land, you get rid of them. You don't intermarry with them. Now, were they under obligation to kill everybody in the world? Just which people? The people who were living in the land of Canaan to alleviate some of that threat. Now, let's go to Deuteronomy 7. In Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, And when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons.
Moab and Canaan are on the list, Canaanites?
I suppose they are.
And Moabites?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that eliminates Ruth, and that eliminates Rahab.
I did not make this law. God said, when you enter the land, you go to these people and you get rid of them. You do not intermarry with them. Now, were they under obligation to kill everybody? They were not. And as far as marriage is concerned, they were told, you do not marry those who are a part of this land because there is a danger involved. Now, the question becomes, because they were not to intermarry with the people of the land, was that a blanket rule that said there is nobody from any other nation that you can't marry? Yes or no? Let's go to Deuteronomy 20 again. In Deuteronomy 20 and verse 10, when you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourself. You shall use the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations nearby. The nations that they were inheriting, what were they to do with the people that were in the land? If they attacked a city far off, were they under obligation to kill everybody? Could they take prisoners? Could they take the women and children? Now let's go over to chapter 21. Chapter 21 and verse 10. When you go out to battle against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take them away captive and see among the captives a beautiful woman and have a desire for her and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity and shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. It shall be, if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes, but you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her. If a man has two wives, stop right there. In one chapter, you find out that a far-off city, you can take captives. What if you find out that among those captives that there's a woman you want for a wife? Can you marry her? Did the law of Moses have a blanket condemnation against marrying all foreigners? The answer is no. And sometimes we may get to thinking it was, but that was not the law. The people of the land you destroy. You don't marry them. There are far off people that you can marry. And that was the law. Now, if we get to thinking about what a difficult thing that was. The whole purpose of this was to keep them from falling into what?
Idolatry.
Now, somebody might argue, well, you know, a woman from a far off city might produce the same result. Might, But if the whole clan's been wiped out, she's been brought back captive, she's pretty much under the thumb. And on some of these things, if somebody says, well, why did God make one law this way and you know, say this here and allow this over here? Sometimes I don't know. It's like some of the dietary laws, I don't know either. It's just my theory is on some of those, just was God was just getting them used to the idea of discriminating. But you have a law. You do not marry the people of the land of the inheritance. There are some from far off cities that you can marry. Now here, as we come to Ezra, the ninth chapter, you notice the way they've stated it here is the people of the land. And they give a long list, and they are very concerned about this. They are concerned about this as being unfaithfulness. And if you notice, of the nations that are listed there, there are definitely several of them that are listed as specific people you stay away from. There are some listed there from other nations that were not specified. And if somebody were to say, well, why do you think they were included? I would say because they were living in the land, that's a maybe, and also because the possibility was still there of drawing them into idolatry. That would be my guess. But what we say about this is definitely they had violated law. Not a law that said there are no foreigners anywhere that can be married, but you cannot marry the people of the land, and that is direct. Any comments? Steve.
I just say the promise is to the children of Abraham. So if they marry and have children with anybody else, then the promise isn't to, or can't be directed towards, the children of Abraham. But, you understand?
No. Say it again. Well, it sounds pretty simple, and yet I see in Deuteronomy 20 and 21 that there were exceptions where people were introduced into the bloodline.
Whenever you have opposing verses, you always need to apply a third.
I do not have opposing verses. I have a situation where God's law says this, and God's law also said, don't marry the people that come from the land. And that's what is done. Now, yes. Yes. Let me come over here. I don't know. I couldn't give you an answer on that. As far as the first time, I know way back when, at the time the law was first given, they talked about people who would come. When they would hear. And there are things, other things that we can point to. You know, there are questions that come up. You know, this Ruth is brought into it. Rahab is brought into it. Even Moses is brought into it. Moses married a what? Married a Cushite, and his brother and sister got all bent out of shape. That's an excellent question. Now we're relating this down to modern times. Hang on to it just one second. Let's just back up and get this out of the way. If we talk about where is the unfaithfulness here, they had married people that God said specifically, you don't marry these people. And Ezra's going to get into his reasoning as he gets into this prayer. And what we're getting at here is the idea you have the people of God and the influences that they bring into their life. These people in chapter 4, when the nations came and said, let us build with you, what was their response? No. separation, bang. Now, 60 years later, in the ninth chapter, is that separation still there? No. They've intermarried with the people of the land, and whatever else you say about it, it is unfaithfulness. It is not because the law of Moses gave a blanket statement that said you never marry outside of Israel. It did not do that. It has nothing to do with, what's the word I'm looking for? The fitness of one race over another. Nothing to do with that. It just, this is what God's law was. You destroy the Canaanites. You don't marry anybody in the land of Canaan. And that's what they did. And this is where the unfaithfulness comes in. Now, if we talk about ourselves today, and, you know, this idea of susceptibility. And by the way, is there any indication yet in Ezra that the intermarriages had really produced any idolatry? I mean, that's the big fear, that intermarriage will produce idolatry. Any indication of it yet?
Hadn't they already intermarried when they were in Babylon with them, when they came back?
Some of them had. Esther was married to a Persian. But this is specifically people of the land that we're talking about. You know, these people in this land, which I promised you, don't marry them. That was the law. The indication at this point, there's no indication yet that they had fallen prey to idolatry. But what we have already seen is they have gone from, no, this is our job, we're going to be separate. Now, 60 years later, yeah, we're now to the stage where we are intermarrying. Now, if you can see that kind of a slide in 60 years, in what direction do you think this is going to go? When we get into Malachi, we're going to see, you know, even more of this. This is the thing that Christians always have to be thinking about these things. Yes. Circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart.
You must remember that Jew is this remnant that came back, this tiny remnant. That's what Jew is. The rest of Israel is much bigger than everywhere else. So that kind of doesn't apply. It's Israel, and these people that are coming back, they're what we call Jew. So most of Israel is scattered. That's why it says so many times that I'm going to scatter you. Four corners of the world. That's I can find that 14 times that I'm going to scatter you out throughout the world.
Nobody denies that they were scattered.
Right. So when we say Jew, we're just talking about this little remnant right here. That's it.
Mike. Mm-hmm. And that's what we are worried about here. Now, if we relate it to ourselves today, whenever you try to bring this straight over and make comparisons, it's difficult. Now, in a sense, is there a comparison that you can make between what these people are doing and the trouble it's causing for them and with Christians marrying non-Christians? Can you draw a parallel? What would the parallel be? And don't intend this to be brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's not to say that it never works. Do y'all know people who married an unbeliever and the unbeliever was converted? We all know people like that. Do y'all know people that married an unbeliever and pretty soon they were nowhere to be found? Yeah. One little illustration that, you know, maybe you've all heard the illustration. Stand up on a table and have somebody stand on the ground, join hands. Is it easier for them to pull you off the table or for you to pull them up? It's a lot easier to get pulled down than it is to pull somebody up. Now, I've seen some guys that could pull people up. They were just that big and strong, but they're much more common to get pulled down than it is to get pulled up. Mike. There were aliens that were going to be amongst them. It's interesting. You'd kind of like to almost go back a couple of thousand years and see daily life in Israel and see just exactly how some of these things played out. Now, in our own time, you know, if we get back to this concept of worried about the influence that others will have upon us, we almost always relate this to marriage. By the time we get into the 10th chapter, we'll find out that this is not just about marriage. There's another statement thrown in there that makes it clear that the closeness that they were achieving with the people of the land wasn't just in whom they were marrying. It was what we would call the concept of being unequally yoked with an unbeliever. So all of these ideas are coming in. Now, the big problem is they have intermarried with people that God specifically said, you shall not intermarry with them. And Ezra is appalled. They have violated the law of Moses. Now, in verses 5 through 15, Ken Simeon, would you read that, please?
Slaves, yet in our bondage our God has forsaken us, but has loving kindness to us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us the reviving, to raise up the house of our God, to restore it, its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. Now, our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you have commanded by your servants the prophets, saying, the land which you are entering to possess it, to possess, is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the land, with their abominations which have filled it from end to end, and their impurity. So now, do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons, and never seek their peace or their prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good things of the land, and leave it as an inheritance to your sons forever. After all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and our great guilt, since you, our God, have acquitted us less than our iniquities deserve, and have given us an escape remnant as this, shall we again break your commandments and intermarry with the peoples who commit these abominations? Would you not be angry with us to the point of destruction, until there is no remnant nor any who escape? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous, for we have been left an escape remnant, as it is this day. Behold, we are before you in our guilt, for no one can stand before you because of this.
Okay, back up to verse 6 for a moment. Here is Ezra. O my God, I am ashamed and embarrassed to lift up my face to you, O God, for our iniquities have risen above our heads and our guilt has grown even to the heavens. Confesses their sin. Reminds me a little bit of Moses here, when Moses was pleading for Israel in the case of the golden calf. He is embarrassed. The seventh verse, since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been in great guilt, and on account of our iniquities, we, our kings and our priests, have been given into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, and to plunder, and to open shame, as it is this day. He understands that the reason they went into captivity was what? Because they had sinned against God. The captivity was a result of iniquity. Now in verses 8 and 9, let's think for a moment about what God had done for them. Now, for a brief moment, grace has been shown by the Lord God. Is there any grace in the Old Testament? Obviously there is. To leave us an escaped remnant and to give us a peg in his holy place. Grace has been shown. They have an escaped remnant. They have a peg in God's holy place. I love that expression. What does that indicate? You got a peg in God's holy place. The way he puts it in the 10th verse, let's look at this again. Or the last part of verse 9. To give us reviving, to raise up the house of our God, to restore its ruin, and to give us a wall in Jerusalem and Judah. When you look at the terms that are used there, does it make it sound big or does it make it sound little? I mean, what's a remnant? A piece. He's just giving us just a little piece to allow us to come back. A peg in his holy place. What's that indicate? Tap, tap, tap. What do you do with a peg? What does it symbolize? You can hang your hat on it. You can hang your coat on it. All it indicates really is that you got a spot there in God's favor. Big spot or little spot, doesn't matter. You got a spot. Yeah. God put it there to hang your hat or to hang your coat on or to hang you on. He gave us a wall. just symbolic language. You know, he just brought us back and gave us. Sunday morning, we used the terminology, give God something to work with. He gave them something to work with. Now, when God gives somebody something to work with, what is the proper response? I mean, if you have been crushed and blown away, sent into the nations, and then suddenly God gives you something to work with, what's the proper response? You do what he says. That's the answer. You do what he says. Now, this is a far-fetched comparison. Yes, you're going to hear it, and you're going to say, boy, that's really far-fetched. I know it, but we're going to do it anyway. I've made several references in the last few weeks to the idea of being in a congregation where you don't have a whole lot of talent, where, you know, shortage of elders, shortage of preachers, shortage of teachers. What happens to people's frame of mind sometimes when they're in that situation for a prolonged period of time? You get burnt out, tired, bah, what's this worth? This is nothing. We feel bad. Take it back to this for a second. A remnant, a peg, a wall. Small group. Hanging on to the nail. Put it that way, just hanging on to the nail. Just the wall, just a spot. If I could correlate that with something, you know, pardon me for bringing it up again, just got back from Africa. Some congregations had a ring of rocks, which is where they worshiped. Are there situations where people could look at their congregation pretty much the same way? Well, if you have been given a remnant or a peg or a wall, what's the proper response? Is it going into a funk or is it gratitude? From Ezra's point, he's bringing this up not to belittle what God had done for them. He's bringing it up to show how God was good to them in relation to what they had done. When we find ourselves in these situations, sometimes what we really need to do is to fight that tendency to say, oh, what is this worth? Back to this idea, who has despised the day of small things? These things are worth something. These things are important. Now, the proper response is gratitude and obedience. And what had these people done? They start out in chapter 4. Nope. This is our job. We come to chapter 9. Okay, we'll mingle. That was not the proper response. Now, granted, it had been 60 years. To us, 60 years is everything. 60 years, a lot of people are dead and gone. Yeah. In God's scheme of things, is 60 years all that much? From God's point of view, would you expect this kind of unfaithfulness in 60 years? You see it time and time again, but it ought not to be. Now, in the 12th verse, chapter 9. We'll read 11 and 12. We'll read 10, 11, and 12. Now, our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you have commanded by your servants the prophets, saying, the land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the lands, with their abominations which have filled it from end to end, and with their impurity. So do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons, and never seek their peace or their prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good things of the land and leave it as an inheritance to your sons forever. The command that is referenced says, people of this land. Again, what is the unfaithfulness? They intermarried with the people of the land, which was specified, you don't do that. In the 14th verse, shall we again break your commandments and intermarry with the peoples who commit these abominations? Would you not be angry with us to the point of destruction until there is no remnant nor any who escape? The point we would make, we always obey God. But how much more should we be scrupulous to obey God when we are on the rebound, trying to recover from bad situations, or finding ourselves in a situation such as this?
Mm-hmm. Here they are, going down that same road again that led them to being captives and it just repeated itself over and over and over again. And that's why he's tearing his beard out.
We made the point last week, some people really look down their nose at slippery slope arguments. Where they are right here, they've intermarried. No indication that they've fallen into idolatry, but they definitely have taken the first step. This chapter is just a classic lesson on the idea of slippery slope. You took this first step. Yes.
The same kind of thing happened with Nehemiah. Do you think it's the same event? I think it's two different events.
No, I think it's two different events because it's at least 13 years later. We were going to use that for another illustration. When you get into these kind of problems and people who are intent on being stubborn, is it sometimes difficult to solve the problem even when you think you have it solved? When you come to the end of Ezra, do you think that the problem is solved? Do you think that it's all done? You think that, we got this whipped. You're going to come back in Nehemiah, and by the time you get to the end of Nehemiah, you're going to find out, nope, here it is again. It's back again. There are some problems that, they repeat themselves, and we're going to see them again. In chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Now while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, a very large assembly, men, women, and children, gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, said to Ezra, "We have been unfaithful to our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land, yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this." We've been unfaithful. We have married women from the land, yet there is hope. Made a point on Sunday morning, want to make it again. Keep your finger there and go to Jeremiah. By the way, just because I think it's interesting, in the book of Jeremiah, three times Jeremiah uses the expression, "Don't pray for this people." Anybody have any idea where those statements are found? Let's go to chapter 7. Chapter 7 and verse 16, "As for you, do not pray for this people, and do not lift up cry for them, and do not intercede for me, for I do not hear you." Find it interesting that God tells the prophet Jeremiah, don't even bother to pray for Judah. Don't even bother to pray for my people. Why would you not pray for somebody? Y'all remember what John said in 1 John 5? There is a sin unto death. I do not say that he shall pray for it. Some sins you're wasting your time praying for. Let's go to the 11th chapter. Chapter 11, verse 13. For your gods are as many as your cities, O Judah, and as many as the streets of Jerusalem are the altars you have set up to the shameful thing, altars to burn incense to Baal. Therefore, do not pray for this people, nor lift up a cry or prayer for them, for I will not listen when they call to me because of their disaster. Don't bother to pray for them. Let's go to chapter 14. Chapter 14 and verse 10. Thus says the Lord to this people, even so they have loved to wander, they have not kept their feet in check, therefore the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and call their sins to account. So the Lord said to me, do not pray for the welfare of this people. When they fast, I'm not going to listen to their cry. And when they offer burnt offering and grain offering, I'm not going to accept them. Rather, I'm going to make an end of them by sword, famine, and pestilence. Three times, he said, don't even bother praying for them. Now, the question is why? Why don't you pray for them? Go to chapter 18. Actually, sending them into captivity was his solution to the problem.
He always said he would never give up. He never gave up.
He had his promise to David. In Jeremiah 18, well, the first 11 verses, the story of the potter, the potter's wheel. You tell my people I can do to them what a potter does. I can build them up, I can tear them down, I can build them up. When I say I'm going to punish them, if they repent, I'll build them up. And then we come to the 12th verse, their reaction. But they will say, it's hopeless, for we are going to follow our own plans, and each of us will act according to the stubbornness of his evil heart. Why aren't we going to pray for this people? It's hopeless. What makes it hopeless?
Their attitude.
Now, did the people of Judah literally stand there and say, it's hopeless? This is kind of a personification. This is what the nation is like. It's hopeless. We're going to do what we want to do. If we talk about a situation being hopeless, a situation isn't hopeless until when? It isn't hopeless unless I say it's hopeless. If I'm determined to be stubborn and self-willed and go my way in spite of anything that God may say, is it hopeless? There is a sin that leads unto death. I do not say that he shall pray for it. Now we come back here to Jeremiah 18. We come back here to Ezra chapter 10 and verse 1. Nevertheless, there is hope for Israel in spite of this. There's hope. There's always hope when what? This is not intended to be difficult. There is always hope when people will listen to what God says and turn themselves around. Thank you. He knew the end from the beginning. He knew how it all would play out.